So much of what has been said and done here this morning has just been exceptionally appropriate, and I appreciate the work that you all have put into your labors publicly, and I hope that what I offer can continue that trend. We are told in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18 by Paul that the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it, that is, the message of the cross, is the power of God. In Galatians chapter 6, verse 14, Paul said, "But God forbid that I should boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom the world has been crucified to me and I to the world." God forbid that I should boast, that I should be proud about anything, arrogant about anything, but I will boast in the cross. Finally, in the Hebrew letter, chapter 12, verse 2, we hear it often, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." When we survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, what do we see? It's possible to grow callous, I think, to the horrors that Jesus endured by a too easy familiarity, if you will. Most of us maybe in this room have heard this time and time and time and time again. We've sat through table talks where many of the events surrounding Jesus' crucifixion were enumerated, described, elaborated upon. We've heard it many a time. And when we start hearing about it again, we may tend to think, "I've heard all this before," and much of what I'm going to say this morning, that's going to be absolutely right. But this is the foundation of it all. Why are you here this morning? Are you here because there happens to be someone who claims to be the Son of God? Or are you here because you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Are you here this morning because this is what your family expects of you? Are you here this morning because this is just what you've always done and you don't feel quite right if you don't do it? Or are you here because God sent His Son to die for you so that you won't have to spend an eternity in hell, and that this is the ultimate act of love, a love that none of us would have done for everyone else? Is that why you're here? If it's not, I hope it'll be why you're here next Sunday, why you're here tonight, after you contemplate it afresh this morning. We're going to go through the events that led up to the crucifixion, and we're going to look at the crucifixion itself. And in so doing, let's do what the Hebrew letter says again. In that 12th chapter, verse 3, "Therefore, consider him who endured such hostility of sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls." So this morning, let's consider him. Let's consider the one who endured such hostility of sinners. They had gathered in the upper room the night before, as you know, to observe the feast of the Passover. And it had been a very positive experience in many ways. They'd gotten to keep the feast, this feast commanded by God. The apostles had had the opportunity to have the Lord wash their feet. What must have been a tremendous and memorable lesson in what it is to be a servant. The Lord's Supper had been instituted. But that night at the table in the upper room had not been positive in every way. In fact, you could argue that there was as much negative as there was positive. Jesus had told them, "One of you is going to betray me." They had lived with him. They had been loved by him and taught by him for some three and a half years. And now he says to them, "One of you is going to betray me." They all said, "Lord, is it I?" Judas asked, "Rabbi, is it I?" Jesus answered, "You have said it." Jesus handed him the piece of bread and said to him, "What you do, do quickly." Judas left that night, going into the night. Receiving the piece of bread, he went out immediately. Jesus informed them that night, "One of you is going to betray me. One of you is going to deny me." He said, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you." Now notice, by the way, in the Greek there's a word for you that's plural. There's a word for you that's singular. Here it's plural. Simon, Simon, Peter, Peter, Satan has asked for you. In other words, perhaps you all, but Simon, I have prayed for you, singular, that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Simon, Simon, Satan's asked for all of you, but I've prayed for you, troubles coming for you. Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. Peter vehemently denied that he would deny. Lord, I'm ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. Even if I die with you, I will not deny you. Jesus said, one of you is going to betray me, one of you is going to deny me, and all of you tonight are going to stumble because of me. Jesus said, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And like Peter, they all proclaim, we're ready to go with you, we're ready to stand with you. But the Lord knew they weren't. And then on top of it all, Jesus washes their feet that night, trying to show them what it is to serve one another. And what do? In the upper room, the very night Jesus is going to suffer his ultimate betrayal, they are arguing about who's going to be the greatest. Do you remember that? Luke chapter 22, verse 24. At least two times before they had done this. And here that very night, they're doing it again. Sometime that evening, they sang a hymn. And the scripture says they headed out of Jerusalem. They went over the brook of Kidron. They went to the Mount of Olives and thus came to the Garden of Gethsemane. Gethsemane means oil press. It was an olive grove at the foot of the Mount of Olives. And when they arrived, Jesus told the disciples, sit here while I go pray over there. And you might be thinking, you might have thought to yourself, now at this moment they knew something was going on. I don't know that they had any idea that something was going on at this point. We know that it was their custom, Jesus' custom to come to this place. We know he'd gone off by himself to pray before. I don't know that the other disciples had any idea at this moment that anything unusual was transpiring. They hadn't understood what was going on with Judas. For all they knew, as we are told, I think by John, they thought Judas maybe was going out to buy something. He was the one who took care of the money. Nothing perhaps struck them as strange at all. But then we read that he took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. Then he said, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch. He had taken these three with him to the Mount of Transfiguration. He had taken them into the room with him when he had raised the ruler's daughter. And now for a third time, he takes these three with him. And he reveals something to them that perhaps he had not revealed to any of the others. Something terrible is going on. And it's irrepressible. I can't hold it back anymore. He chose not to. They didn't understand, but now they knew something was going on. Jesus left the three apart from the others, and then he himself went away to pray. So three phases. Three times he prays that night. He went a little farther and fell on his face, we read in Matthew, and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. He prayed something like this all three times. His flesh was crying out to be delivered. He returns to his disciples as he would do two other times, and what does he find them doing? Sleeping. You know, you ask yourself, why does Jesus do it this way? Why doesn't he just go off one time and say the prayer and come back? Why does he go, come back, go, come back, go, come back? Well, God does things in threes, but surely there's more to it than that. Is it to teach the apostles? Perhaps so. Is it because God had withheld from Jesus the hour that Judas would arrive and he keeps coming back wondering if that's the occasion? I don't know. If he was coming back for comfort from the apostles, he didn't get it. Every time he found them sleeping. Sleeping from sorrow, Luke says. You ever been so upset that you just wanted to lay down and sleep? They are now affected enough. They don't know what's going on, but they know something is. They're so upset by what they see in Jesus that they're having a hard time staying awake. An angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. He's not getting it from Peter, James, and John. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. It's interesting that Luke, the physician, is the only one who records this for us. There's a rare condition, but there is a documented condition called hematidrosis. Pardon me. Though it is rare, it's well documented. And what happens is the capillaries, under great anguish, the capillaries in the sweat glands will actually break. And the blood and the sweat will be mixed. And that may well be what Jesus was enduring. That in and of itself can create tremendous exhaustion, perhaps even shock. Jesus was already suffering. He'd had to tell those things to the apostles in the upper room. All this while, he had known what was coming. Now, it's right at the brink. Have you ever had one of those experiences where something terrible you thought was going to be terrible, and nothing like this, but something terrible. You were dreading it, and then the moment finally arrives where it's about to happen. Judas arrives. And Judas doesn't arrive alone. Mark tells us he arrived with a great multitude. Judas, having received a detachment of troops, John 8 tells us, detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. It's easy to miss these things because we're not looking at it in the original language. The word for detachment in John 18:3 is spera in the Greek. It's a tenth of a legion. Judas would have had with him somewhere between 500 and 1,000 Roman troops. If you've imagined a scenario like I think perhaps I have in time past, that Judas shows up that night, maybe he's got a handful, maybe 20 people with him. It's nothing like that at all. He's got a small army with him. John 18:12 says there was a captain, a chiliarchos is the Greek word, meaning a military tribune, a commander of a cohort, about 600 men. Judas shows up with a small army. He's got Roman legionnaires with him. He's also got the officers of the Jews, the Jewish guard of the temple under the Sanhedrin, these armed Levites. They come with torches and swords and clubs, as if you were coming out to get the worst of criminals. They come out that night, probably can be heard from a great distance. And for whatever reason, because it was night, because there were going to be so many people, I don't know precisely why, because Jesus was a nondescript individual, Judas said, "The one I kiss, he's the one." Immediately, he went up to Jesus and said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. It's hard to conceive more audacity and more treachery than what Judas was guilty of at that moment. To have a heart that would have received nothing but good all these years, and to know who the Lord was, and to go up to Him and do that, to toy with the Lord's grace. Jesus responds, "Friend, why have you come?" Or as the NIV and NAS say, "Friend, do what you have come for." They laid hold of Jesus, and when the disciples saw what was going to happen, it looks to me like perhaps this is the first moment now where they see what's really going on. Even with all these soldiers, they don't know what's going on. I mean, this is Judas. This is one of them. What's going on here? But when they lay hands on Jesus, then they realize what this is about. And they said to him, "Lord, shall we strike with the sword?" How many swords do they have? Two. They do have two. One gets pulled, but they have two. I don't know that Peter even bothered to wait. He just pulls out his sword and goes at it. Two swords. And you know, I think, I'll just say this as an aside, the apostles deserve some credit here, don't they? Here are 500 to 1,000 Roman soldiers, probably armed to the hilt. And here are some fishermen, a tax collector, and whatever else, with two swords. And what do they say? "Lord, shall we fight?" They're ready to fight. They don't understand the nature of the kingdom yet. I think it's interesting that Peter doesn't deny the Lord until after he's told he can't fight with a sword. He was ready to go with you to prison and to death. He was ready to fight so long as he thought it was a physical battle. I think Peter may have been a very physically capable man. When they saw the Lord on the shore, they rode in. What did Peter do? He jumps in the water and he swims to shore. I can't prove it, but I think Peter may have been one of those men who's just very physically capable, had a presence about him. He was a leader of men. And so long as this was a physical battle in his mind, he was ready. But when he was told he couldn't fight, didn't quite know what to do with himself at that point. And that's when he gets unsure, and that's when he does something terrible that night. But whatever the case, Jesus tells him to put the sword away. Matthew and Mark both record for us then that all the disciples forsook him and fled, just as he had said they would. The detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. They led him away to Annas first. I don't know precisely why they do that, but they did. And that night, and this begins a series of six trials, six hearings that Jesus goes through that night in which justice is not served. Before Annas, we read the following. The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, "I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said." And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" He then is sent bound, we are told, to Caiaphas the high priest. Caiaphas brings forth false witnesses. Caiaphas himself lays a false accusation at the Lord's feet. The high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." Now the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him. Now he was hit when he was before Caiaphas, before Annas. Now we read, while he is before Caiaphas, he is mocked, he is beaten. Having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, "Prophesy, who is the one who struck you?" And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. Matthew records for us that they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands. And somewhere in the midst of all this, the rooster crows, and Jesus is able to turn and make eye contact with Peter, who had denied that night three times already the Lord who was about to die for him. Morning then comes. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council. They questioned him about his identity, just as they had before Caiaphas, and when he gave them the truth, they plotted against him to put him to death. And when they had bound him a third time, we're told, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Pilate listened to the things they were accusing Jesus of. The multitude, perhaps it says, began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes of seat to Caesar," which of course was an outright lie. He had said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." They answered and said to Pilate, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." And what does Pilate say in the midst of all this? "I find no fault in this man." Three times at least, Pilate says that. "I find no fault in this man." Pilate then heard that Jesus was from Galilee. And when he hears this, he realizes, well, this is not my jurisdiction. This is Herod's. Herod happened to be in town at the time, so he sends Jesus over to Herod. And Herod was excited about seeing Jesus. Anybody remember why? He'd been hoping to see a miracle. He questions Jesus. Jesus answers him nothing. And then there's more. The chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated with him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. One thing I have missed in time past, at least, is that we're going to see the Roman soldiers put that purple robe on him, or that scarlet robe on him. But when he's before Herod, they put what is called, the New King James calls, a gorgeous robe on him. It looks like he was mocked perhaps as a Jewish monarch, and then mocked also as a Roman monarch. He was made fun of on both sides. Well, Herod doesn't get what he wants from him, so he sends him back to Pilate. To Annas, to Caiaphas, to the Sanhedrin, to Pilate, to Herod, and now to Pilate. Things were reaching their climax. Three times Pilate attempts to free Jesus. Pilate declares again, "I find no fault in this man," that Herod hasn't either. Pilate was ready to chastise him, as you know, and set him free. The people cry out for Barabbas. "We know this fellow is an insurrectionist. We know he's a murderer, but give us him to keep the Jesus." Pilate, wishing to release Jesus, tries a second time, but they shouted, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" You can just see the mob before their magistrate. "Crucify him!" Pilate says to them the third time, we're told, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." But they would not have it. Pilate takes Jesus and scourges him. I assume many of you, if not all of you, know something about this scourging. They would have these thongs to which were attached pieces of nails or bones. They'd bring that down on the bare back. The individual might have been tied to a post so that the back would be laid bare. Sometimes the lashing was so bad the entrails would be exposed. Beat him within an inch of death. Jesus endures that, and you think, surely this is enough. Pilate wanted it to be enough. But Matthew 27 says, Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. So now we have the Lord who's been beaten, spat upon, lied about, called a blasphemer, betrayed, denied, fled from, without a friend in the world, at least among the men. And now the Roman soldiers are gathered around him. "Strong bulls of Bashan have encompassed me." They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Clothes are coming off and on that scourged back. When they twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. Look at the trouble that men are going to mock the Lord. It's not enough to say, "Oh yeah, you're the king of the Jews." That would be bad enough. But now they go to the trouble. Take the clothes off. Okay, put this on. Okay, here's your scepter. Hold it. They bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they spat on him and took the reed. "Here, I'll show you how to use that scepter," you can imagine one of them saying. They took the reed and struck him on the head. Then Jesus came out. See, the people are out here. This was happening inside. Jesus came out, we're told, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. There must have been blood everywhere. And Pilate said to them, what were three words did he say? Not yet. "Behold the man." Have you ever thought what Pilate meant by that? Why did he say, "Behold the man"? I'd never thought a whole lot about that until sometime back when I was looking into this more closely. I don't think these were words of mockery, not from what we see in Pilate at all. What's Pilate saying? He's saying, "Look at him! Look at him! Haven't you had enough yet? This man has, I find no fault in this man. I see no reason for death in this man. Look how he takes it! Look at him!" But the people only responded with what? "Crucify him. You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him," Pilate said. After meeting with Jesus again, Pilate's drawing this out as long as he politically can. He walks again into the praetorium, and we read, "From then on, Pilate sought to release him. He asked the Jews, 'Shall I crucify your king?' But the chief priests answered, 'We have no king but Caesar.' So Pilate, so that his name will eternally live in infamy, delivers Jesus to be crucified. And they led him away. He, bearing his cross, went to a place called the Place of a Skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha. This patibulum is what they called. The crossbar weighed something like 110 pounds. Jesus had been beaten. It's possible he'd had nothing to eat for all these hours, nothing to drink. The exhaustion of blood loss, all those things taken together, he was not able to carry the crossbar all the way. Simon was compelled to bear it the rest of the way. While he's walking, women are weeping. He overhears them. He says, "Don't weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children." In Luke 23:33 tells us they came to Calvary and there they crucified him. The Bible is a study in the brevity of expression. Had you left it up to men by themselves, what would they have done? They probably would have gone into all the gory details, perhaps, to try to help people feel the pain or to make it more sensational. The Bible just says they crucified him. Crucifixion was an old art by the first century. It had been used by the Egyptians, the Carthaginians, the Scythians, Assyrians, the Indians, the Germans, and from earliest times among Greeks and Romans. And it was by Romans and Jews alike considered the worst form of death. Of course, to the Jews especially, because what did the law say? Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Accursed of God. Punishment on the cross was normally at least confined to slaves and to malefactors of the worst kind. It also was something that a Roman citizen could not be subjected to. But of course, Jesus was not a Roman citizen. He wasn't the other things either. Before nailing him to the cross, they offered him sour wine mingled with gall. This was a mild analgesic meant to deaden the pain. Jesus doesn't take it. Have you ever given thought to why? Had you been in that situation, would you have taken it? I probably would have. Of course, anything to help with the pain. Jesus doesn't take it. Why not? Well, the Bible doesn't tell me. But can you imagine what people might have said? Hear all these things Jesus said on the cross. Woman, behold your son. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. It is finished. My God, why have you forsaken me? Right out of Psalm 22:1. What would people have said about the things that Jesus said had he taken that drug? It was the drug talking. I wonder if that was part of it. No, Jesus had his mind. There was nothing in the way. He was thinking clearly, perfectly. Sometimes the crossbar with the criminal already fastened would be nailed to the upright, or the criminal would be nailed to the cross and then lifted up so that his limbs were about 3 to 4 feet off the ground. However it was done with Jesus, it is quite a thing to contemplate that there's some Roman soldier whose name we don't know, that's lost to history, but there's some Roman soldier who has the terrible distinction of being the one who took that tent spike and placed it in the right place and drove it home. And then to the other arm. And then to the feet. 1968, a discovery was made in the area of Jerusalem. A man by the name of Yohanan, who appeared to have been crucified at about the same era time that Jesus was. And they noticed the nail that was driven through his feet was a little different than we've tended to think about it, at least. When you imagine Jesus' feet being nailed to the cross, you may kind of have this picture of his feet being crossed over each other and the nail going through the two. In Yohanan's case, the nail, about 7 inches long, had been driven through his heel bone. And there's evidence to suggest now that what they would actually do, at least some of the time, was you'd have the upright and the heels would be placed on either side. And then the nail would be driven through the heel bones. So it kind of changes the picture. I can imagine the pain that that would have produced. Now begins the wait. Generally, the sufferer was left to die of exhaustion. If they were only tied to the cross, like they sometimes were, they could go on for a very long time. There's cases on record of it going up to 9 days. So that no friends or family come to help and take the crucifixee down, you had the centurion and the 4 soldiers there. Possibly leaving Jesus with nothing but a loincloth, they take his clothes, and he may have even overheard them, casting lots to see who would get the garment. And they're not done. Those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, "He saved others. Himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now if he will have him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.' You hear the blasphemy? The mockery? Even the robbers who were crucified reviled him with the same thing, we're told by Matthew. After approximately 6 hours, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And after almost 24 hours of continual mockery and beating and blaspheming and lying, he said, it is finished. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, and breathed his last. Now, why did he do that? Paul tells us in Galatians 2, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men, all nations, to myself. There is nothing so magnetic as love. Jesus went through all that because he loves you. He loves you. See, he sees what we don't see. He knows what hell is all about. He knows the wonderful thing he wants to give you. He knows all these things that could become a reality for you. And he wants to give it to you. And he knows the price you're going to pay if you don't get it. And so he does all this and more. It's 11:32, Sunday morning. Jesus has just made it clear to you, as he's done many times before, I'm sure, that he loves you. And he's not calling you to give him a little bit of your time. And he's not calling you to come and be a fan, an enthusiastic admirer who just shows up at church and has good things to say. He's calling you to be a follower. To put it all down like he did. And come follow him. If you've got anything this morning that's more important to you than that, please don't come forward. But if you are ready and have decided in your heart that being a full-out, full-blown follower of Jesus is how you want to spend the rest of your life, and you are ready to pay every price, because there will be a price, then now is the time. Please come forward while we stand and sing.